Karen and I would like to thank all the listeners who are supporting us at Patreon or have provided reviews on iTunes. If you'd like to join in on that support, check us out at monstertalk.org/support or at patreon.com/monstertalk. Thank you so much for your help in producing this show.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith. Karen's away this week, but we'll be back soon. Recently, my social media feed blew up with links to a story about a biology research project looking into Loch Ness and the legend of Nessie with the technology of environmental DNA. I was somewhat concerned as I saw numerous responses from my friends online saying, Nessie isn't real, why bother? And other things along those lines, clearly missing the point of the actual study. If these well-intentioned folks had bothered to read past the headlines, they'd have seen that the actual study was actually quite interesting. Yes, the news story headlines were about Nessie, but the underlying science was about using DNA research to assess the various species living in multiple Scottish lakes. Imagine that, using monsters to promote science research. Well, you can see why it's right up my alley. So I reached out to the lead researcher, Professor Neil Gimmel, and he was kind enough to conduct a Monster Talk interview on very short notice. Not only that, but this interview took place while he was on the shores of Loch Ness. He turned his camera to the window at one point and showed me the still waters outside as we talked. Alas, our connection was so poor that I didn't keep our video going, and honestly, the quality of his side of the call got pretty bad at some points, but I believe after editing, all but one of our exchanges turned out to be understandable. For that one, you'll hear me interrupt the conversation in post-production to explain what he said. Other than that one spot, though, I think we got a good enough recording that should all make sense. My apologies for the quality where it drops, but keep in mind that we're using a free technology that allows us to conduct real-time video conferences across the ocean, such that I could be lurking in my basement in Georgia, here in Monster Talk Central, while he's in his cabin on the shores of Loch Ness. I wish we didn't have quality issues with the audio, but Professor Gimmel is certainly worth listening to, and I hope you find our discussion as interesting as I did. Oh, and here's another little bit of Monster Talk trivia. Dr. Gimmel got the idea for doing his eDNA research of the Loch while reading Darren Nash's book, Haunting Monster. A link to Darren's book, which is now available in paperback, will be in the show notes at monstertalk.org.
Monster Talk.
So Professor Neil Gimmel is the Ag Research Chair in Reproduction and Genomics at the University of Otago. He's been in the forefront of media coverage surrounding a collaborative project to use environmental DNA to look at species present in Loch Ness, home of the famous legendary Loch monster, Nessie. So welcome to Monster Talk, Neil.
Yeah, hi Blake, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for making time for us. I know you've got a busy schedule right now.
Yeah, it's been a bit crazy, and we've been just arrived here at Loch Ness 2 days ago. So, yesterday. So I'm even losing track of time. It's been that busy.
I imagine so. It's interesting. So I saw several stories, you know, rolling around on my social media because we cover monsters and cryptozoology and science. Everybody was sending me this. But what surprised me was a lot of my friends on social media are very much pro-science people, but they seemed, honestly, to be a little concerned about the use of Nessie in a science project. I don't think they were actually reading the article because the article sounded wonderful to me. I always think using monsters to promote science and advance those kind of ideas is a really great project. But can you tell us a little bit about the study and what the purpose of it is beyond what the headlines are telling us?
Well, yeah, sure, Blake. It's pretty straightforward, really. I mean, we want to understand what's living in Loch Ness. We don't believe there's a monster there, but we think that there's a great opportunity to use this environmental DNA technology to understand what is living there, the fish, the plants, the microorganisms, the invertebrates, the whole shebang can be studied now using this environmental DNA. And who knows? Maybe there is something unknown to science in the murky depths of Loch Ness. Scotland's got a monster problem. So there are about 13 different lochs here in Scotland that have recordings or reports of some kind of monster or mythical creature. So Nessie's the most famous of the bunch, but Loch Mora, which is another big loch here in Scotland, has a monster by the name of Morag. There's another loch that's just south of Ness called Oik, and that's got a monster called Wee Oiki. And then there's a whole bunch of others that have been reported and have names that are predominantly in Gaelic and I can't pronounce. But the point is that there's lots of legends of monsters here, particularly related to the lochs, and I guess it's underpinned by the Celtic myth of the water horse or the Kelpie. So, or we will be sampling from some of these other sites where monsters may be present, and we'll be looking to see if there's anything different about those between Loch Ness and those other sites, or indeed what's similar. So we'd expect to see a lot of the same fish species, we'd expect to see a lot of other things. I guess what's different amongst those is also interesting to us. But yes, the idea is that you would try to use these control sites to figure out what's special about Loch Ness, but it turns out that maybe there are other sites that have monsters. Who knows?
So the from a species perspective, where do these lochs get their fish from? I mean, do all of them, are they connected in some way?
So Loch Ness, well, it sits at the north of Scotland, and it connects to the ocean through the Moray Firth. And there's a short piece of river called the Ness River. It's only about 6 miles long. So Ness effectively connects to the Moray Firth and then the North Sea on the east side of the north side of Scotland by about 6 miles of river. And so it's open, and salmon and other species can swim through the Ness River into Loch Ness. So there's migratory eels, there's migratory salmon, lampreys. They're all known to move from the sea into Loch Ness. Occasionally seals are seen in the loch and other species that have obviously come from the oceans. And then from Loch Ness, you go down through the southern end into what's called the Caledonian Canal, which is basically modified natural rivers which connect a large number of other lochs, including Loch Oik, which I mentioned before, which has the monster called Wee Oiki. So clearly the lochs are all connected, and if there were monsters, perhaps they can have a party from time to time because they could move between these sites. So there is a degree of connection. So Loch Ness is not separate or isolated in any way.
Neat. When you're looking at the DNA, what would distinguish a lake monster from the more mundane species?
Yeah, well, it'd be something we can't easily identify on the tree of life, I'd say, for a starting point. So we're working on the premise of hypothesis testing. So we expect that when we go looking at our samples, that we'll see DNA from a variety of fish species, including things like trout and salmon and perhaps lamprey and eels and pike and a whole variety of fish that have been previously documented in the loch. And then we would expect also to find a large number of bacteria and algae and various other things. What we are less sure we will find is any evidence of some of the hypotheses that have been put forward to explain Loch Ness. So, of course, the most outrageous of these is the so-called Jurassic hypothesis.
This is the one section where Neil's audio cut out to the point that I need to insert what he was saying. What he says is the most outrageous hypothesis is the so-called Jurassic hypothesis, that somewhere out there is a prehistoric species like a plesiosaur that somehow escaped extinction. If such DNA was found, while we don't know exactly what plesiosaur DNA looks like, we could make an educated guess about what it would look like, even though we don't have any intact DNA to compare it to.
But we can actually use a process called ancestral state reconstruction to figure out what a plesiosaur sequence should look like within reasonable bounds. So we would expect a plesiosaur sequence to sit somewhere in the modern tree of life around about where the crocodiles and birds are.
That's fascinating.
That sort of ballpark. And so we're looking for a sequence, not a crocodile, not a bird, not a snake or lizard. Something reptilian, clearly, but new to science. And if we found something like that, well, I would be highly surprised, but I'd also
then be setting out to do further experiments to prove that we could replicate that finding. And in fact, actually, it's a very important part of our process is that we need to have some level of replication, and we also need to have some level of observer bias so that people don't look at the Loch Ness samples more than they look at any other samples, because the temptation would be to spend more time and energy looking at Loch Ness because there's meant to be something special there. So anyway, so the plesiosaurus, it's the most grand of the ideas. There are some that are other more mundane ideas. A giant catfish, like the Wells catfish, which is a European catfish. These are monstrous animals. So they grow to 14 or 16 feet in length. They can be hundreds of pounds in weight. And in fact, you know, thinking about a standard family car, you're probably talking about something that's about half the size of a standard family car. And I would have to say, if something that had the head, the width or half the width of my car's bonnet, then, and that, I saw that thing come up underneath my boat, I'd think I'd seen a monster too. So the Wells catfish is supposedly introduced by the Victorians into a variety of waterways here in Britain in the late 1800s. They can, we think, live to 100 years of age or more. So it is possible, even if they weren't breeding, that one of those fish has survived over time and is in Loch Ness. Although, again, improbable, but you just don't know. And then the other idea that Adrian Shine that we work with has put forward is the idea that migratory sturgeons might be an explanation for some of the monster sightings. And again, we know what a sturgeon's DNA looks like, and we could look for evidence of whether we see any sequences that approximate what we think a sturgeon would look like in terms of its DNA sequence profile.
I would love it if there was a really good photograph of that so we could have the sturgeon photo. That'd be...
You know, clearly there's a lot of sturgeon up in North America, pig-nosed sturgeon, things like that. Again, big animals, 16 foot in length, hundreds of pounds in weight, live for years. And they're not even the biggest ones. I think the biggest ones are the ones from Siberia. So yeah, there's a lot of plausible explanations that we can test. So we will do so.
Other biological concerns about the species in the loch that this might be helpful for, like people who are, does this tell us anything about the population or merely the existence? Because I was curious about whether, you know, the DNA samples tell you anything about how many of an animal might be present.
Yeah, it's very hard to quantify off these data at the moment. That's something that many people around the world are trying to figure out. So it's pretty much, you can get an idea of abundance from the total quantity of DNA sequence, but it's hard to scale that because, you know, big creatures will release more DNA, small creatures will have less because they've got fewer cells. So we need a better way to quantify that. So at the moment, it's predominantly descriptive. This was present, but we don't necessarily know how many of them there are.
Right. Does the depth of the loch, when you're doing these samples, are you expecting to see, like, do you think the temperature and other factors will, like, affect the distribution of the DNA across the samples?
Well, it certainly affects the distribution of species. So we are going to be looking at temperature profiles and salinity profiles. We know there's a thermocline in Loch Ness. In fact, actually, the thermocline has been responsible for a lot of the potential sightings that have been made over the years, we think. So logs submerge and then re-emerge from time to time, partly driven by the fact that there is this temperature differential which creates currents, and sometimes these currents run counter to the wind direction. So what happens is you might have a northerly wind, and yet people see objects moving against the wind, so the natural instinct is to say, okay, it's moving, therefore QED, it's swimming, and therefore it's a monster because it's going against the direction of the prevailing wind. But, in fact, Adrian Shine has shown that there's dynamic water movements in Loch Ness driven by thermal differences. So underwater waste is one of the things that they've discovered, and that the water and the currents can be moving in the opposite direction to the wind-blown currents.
Interesting.
So you get objects like logs that rise and fall in the water, so they submerge and then they re-emerge, and occasionally they can be moving opposite to the general prevailing wind flow. And the explanation that many people have said is, okay, it's moving against the wind, therefore it must be swimming. But it doesn't have to be. It could easily be the currents that occur within Loch Ness that are driving that.
You're looking at water on this particular study. This is me just hypothesizing, but would it be true or would it be reasonable to suspect that the sediments that fall on the bottom of the loch form something like a historical record in the same way ice cores do? Would you be able to do a mud sample at the bottom and tell about the species variations over time with that kind of a sample?
Yeah, maybe. DNA can preserve in sediments longer than it can in water, but we just don't know how long. A lot would depend on basically how protected it was from microorganism damage. So funnily enough, tonight we were just talking to Adrian Shine about cores that he took of sediments 25 years ago for a project called the Rosetta Project. And it was quite revolutionary, really. So Adrian managed to get a device 230 metres down to the bottom of Loch Ness, and then he managed to sample deep into the loch, 6 metres plus. And that goes back 9,500 years, so basically to the time of the last glaciation here.
Wow.
And he's got a couple of cores like that. He's got some others that are shorter, and he still has them on a shelf up in the top of his loft. So they've been stored dry, which is not ideal. People that do this coring would routinely freeze them. But we are going to give it a go and see if we can get some DNA out of his cores and see if we might be able to find evidence of what species were present in the sediment cores, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 9,000 years ago. I think the prospects of getting something good are probably pretty low, but, you know, within my team that we've assembled here, we've got people from the University of Copenhagen, from Tom Gilbert's lab, and, you know, Tom's an expert on paleogenomics. If anyone can do this, he probably can. So we'll give it a go.
That's fantastic. Seems like a low-cost, low-risk way to approach the problem without having to do new core samples.
Yeah, well, core sampling is really hard.
Yeah.
So Adrian described it as a bit of a moonshot, and he's probably right. It would have been a lot of work, and if we were to do that sort of project again, it would take quite a lot of kit and time. So I think he had a rig deployed on the bottom of Loch Ness for a couple of weeks, and you know, that's a lot of boat time.
Yeah, yeah.
And a higher level of risk that you might actually achieve nothing. So the weather here is actually phenomenal at the moment. So if we'd had all the equipment, maybe we could give it a go again, but not this trip.
So you've got this team together. How expensive is a project like this? Is this something that will be affordable to come back and do again and get some sort of samples over time?
So it's hard to guess exactly I should know how much it's cost. I can tell you that the boat and the skipper, the Loch Ness project has donated to us, so we haven't had to pay for any of that. Pretty much everybody that's working on the project is donating their time for free. I'm paying for some accommodation. I'm paying for food. I haven't paid people to fly here except for my student and myself. So in that regard, it's a reasonably low-cost project. Where it gets expensive is when we start buying the gear to take the samples. So that was a few thousand dollars. When we process the samples, it's going to be a few thousand dollars more. So what are we looking at now? Probably $10,000 in reagents costs, probably with the accommodation bills, and airfares are probably another $10,000. So not cheap by any stretch of the imagination. And then it gets even more expensive when we start going to the lab and doing the sophisticated genetics. So there you're probably talking about $30,000, and then probably another $30,000 to do the sequencing. So that adds up to pretty much close to $100,000. And where's the money coming from? I'm mostly paying for it out of bits of money that I've managed to accumulate from projects over time. And I'm also hopeful that some suppliers will donate their services. So, for example, the $20,000 worth of lab costs that I mentioned, I got an email last week, and it looks like a company might come to the party on that. The sequencing, it looks very, very likely that a company called Illumina, who are one of the leaders in sequencing technologies, will probably help us with that. And we look to have some support from a local company here in the UK. So hundreds of thousands of dollars is the answer, but we're not paying that.
That's fantastic, though. I mean, it's expensive, yet it sounds like some really good return on the dollar for this kind of data that you're going to get out of this.
Yeah, so this science that we do, genetics, is not a cheap science by any stretch of the imagination. The equipment and the chemicals are expensive. But, you know, the insights that we're gaining from the work are quite extraordinary from time to time. So it's easy to say, oh, this genetics project is very expensive. Or some more cynical out there would say, oh, that's a lot of money to spend looking for something that does not exist. And it's not about the monster. The monster is an opportunity to get people interested in science. Okay? So for us, it's all about what's in Loch Ness. And it's measuring that biodiversity. It's understanding what the life of that loch is like in June 2018. It's establishing a baseline from which we can do further experiments down the track or help people who have interesting questions of their own. So, for example, we're working with UK collaborators who are working on the patterns of movement of migratory fish species. Well, our Loch Ness sample is going to be really, really important to answer some of their questions. There's another project that's worked with the Scottish Natural Heritage Society, and they are interested in what are the biological markers of healthy lake or loch systems. And again, this will fit into part of the total package of what people know about lochs in Scotland, and we can make some assessment about how healthy Loch Ness is. So I think we'll get multiple science publications out of this work, as well as being able to explain to people what we're doing, why eDNA is powerful, and hopefully get them excited about the prospect of using that in other contexts. And who knows, we might even find a monster.
I tell you what, Neil, you this project is so close to my heart. This is exactly the sort of thing that we try to do with Monster Talk. The fascination in monsters just naturally bleeds over into a really useful way of looking at biology and trying to understand science and to understand evolution and how all the things are related. There's so much there. I'm just really stoked for you. I hope you find something really cool. And I realize that really cool is not particularly scientific, but you know, I love this. So
yeah, so do we, and that's what we're excited about. We're excited about the opportunity to excite people about science. I mean, basic fundamental science. If I told you about eDNA without a monster hook, we'd probably get 2 column inches in the local paper if we are lucky. You know, we've been in the headlines of papers all around the world. We've got media coming, this week from major channels in the US. We've got NBC, we've got CBS, we've got Sky and various other channels here in the UK, BBC. And what a great opportunity to get people excited about an adventure, because it is an adventure. We don't know what we're going to find. It might be quite mundane at the end of it, but I think it's still an adventure. And eDNA is cool. I mean, it really is cool. So there was a paper published in about a month ago describing sharks in the Pacific. And the eDNA tools identified 44% more shark species than any of the other tools that we would use routinely to measure shark diversity.
Wow.
So normally what you do is you put a chunk of flesh out on a hook, and you put it next to a video camera, and you look to see what comes around and eats the meat, right? That's basically how we survey sharks. And that works pretty well, but some sharks are actually pretty shy, and so they don't come to the meat, they don't eat it, they don't get video recorded, and you never know they're there. But with eDNA, you do. So here is a way to look at our world and identify those hidden things, those hidden creatures, which are important parts of our total understanding of those systems, but that we've been missing. So I love that we are able to use this tool to explore our world in a different way. And it turns out, even though I told you the price tag for the Loch Ness project is pretty high, if we were to do it with submarines or drones or, you know, nets, towing nets up and down the loch, or sonar, that's all really expensive too. you know, because you're paying for people's time, you're paying for their expertise, you're paying for the equipment. So a science project like ours, which is going to produce maybe three papers, give or take, plus get a whole heap of people interested in science, hopefully, even if it's $100,000, $200,000, that doesn't seem unreasonable to me.
No, that sounds great. I know you have another thing that we're bumping up against, so I'll end this. But I hope that when you get a little further down the road with your sample investigation, we can talk again about how things are going, because this is really interesting.
Yeah, happy to do that. And you know, it's all part and parcel of what we're doing is trying to, you know, get people interested in potential. Because I think, say, maybe not next year, but in 5 or 10 years' time, these sequencing devices will be cheap enough. And it's not going to be quite Star Trek, but these sequencing devices are going to be cheap enough that you'll be able to buy one probably at your local corner store that you can plug into your phone or whatever personal device you're carrying. And if you wanted to, if you chose to, you could monitor your natural world in a way which is quite unprecedented. You get a lot of DNA sequence information. You don't even know have to know that much about DNA sequence, because the app on your phone will probably interrogate that, and it'll spit out to you, these species are present here. I mean, it becomes a really interesting toolkit for understanding what's present in our environment. And, you know, recreational fishing people might be interested in that. People might be interested in this if they're, you know, going out surfing or swimming to know what species are out there. They might be interested in just running it across the salad bar at their local restaurant. To make sure there aren't any bacteria that are likely to kill them.
Yeah.
These are important things. So I predict this technology is going to change our world in a lot of different ways. And Loch Ness is just a starting point for that conversation and that education of people and help bring them on that journey.
Let's finish up with every episode when we interview someone new, we try to ask them this question. What's your favorite monster?
Yeah, so that was a really interesting one. I was fascinated and also terrified by Medusa when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And does that count?
Absolutely.
I mean,
yeah.
This is mythical, I guess.
So, my daughter's the Gorgons and the whole idea of snakes. Yeah. Did you ever see The Seven Faces of Dr. Liao with Tony Randall?
No.
They have a wonderful Medusa in there. She's really it's Tony Randall, but his snake hair is sort of stop motion in a Harryhausen kind of effect.
Yeah. I might remember that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I'm remembering some of the old stop motion stuff, you know, from in black and white. Medusa was scary.
Yeah, she was.
Whatever.
Or she still is scary. Yeah.
Still is scary, and so that was quite terrifying. And I also remember a show called The Tomorrow People, which was a British show, and these Tomorrow People had telepathic powers, and they could do a thing called jaunting. They could basically will themselves to be any part of the universe. Anyway, in one of those episodes, they met a sort of Anubis-like god, and that thing terrified the crap out of me too. So Probably Medusa.
Like a dog-headed sort of thing?
Yeah, dog-headed sort of human thing.
Yeah,
but
wow.
But ate hearts and killed people.
Well, I've heard of that show before. I love to watch old British television, so I'll have to see if I can look that up.
Yeah, it was pretty good, actually. That's the 70s. We're going back a ways now, but fortunately there's a whole bunch of people who have loaded that stuff up onto YouTube and other sites, which is just wonderful if you've got a nostalgic streak, which I do from time to time.
I do. It's almost debilitating.
Yeah, well, I try to get my kids to watch it, but they just don't want to watch it because it's just not exciting enough, I think.
It can be a little slow. I just got my daughter to watch Night of the Demon or Curse of the Demon, which is based on an M.R. James story. I just love that last night. And I think she was genuinely scared, even though I think the effects don't really hold up very well. But it's such a good story. So,
yeah.
Anyway, I better let you go so you have a break before your next interview. Thank you so much. I'll send you an email when this is going to go live. And I really appreciate it and hope you do well with your research. And I'd like to hear how things turn out.
Monster Dog.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm your host, Blake Smith, and you just heard an interview with Professor Neil Gimmel, who's conducting an environmental DNA survey of several Scottish lochs to find out what species live there, and perhaps to find any undiscovered monsters. Like Professor Gimmel, I don't expect he'll find plesiosaurs, but as you've heard, he'll be able to test several hypotheses about the loch and the life forms therein, with many different watery environments being tested. I commend him for combining a love of monsters with a love of good science. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The opinions expressed on this show are those of myself and my guests, and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. There we have links to our Patreon pages as well as a donation button. A great way to support the show is to buy us books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones. And we love Kindle, and we can share our digital library with each other. Finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please, share our show on your favorite social media platforms.
Save the date for a colossal PsyCon 2018. Bigger venue, bigger stars, bigger ideas, bigger fun. Las Vegas, October the 18th to the 21st, 2018. PsyCon is already one of the planet's premier skeptical conferences, where hundreds of critical thinkers come to Las Vegas, the city of illusions, to hear from the leading lights of science and skepticism. For 2018, we want PsyCon to be bigger than ever. We've even booked a bigger hotel. Come to Las Vegas at the Westgate Resort and Casino to see the brilliant and hilarious Stephen Fry on stage with Richard Dawkins. An opening night talk by Steven Pinker on the ideas behind his new book, Enlightenment Now. The triumphant return of James the Amazing Randi. Plus, New York Times science writer Carl Zimmer, psychologist and memetics expert Susan Blackmore, the Psy-Babe Yvette D'Entremont, virologist and advocate for science-based medicine Paul Offit, and many, many more, along with comic musician George Rabb, serving as Master of Ceremonies, a magic show from Banachek, author book signings, and of course, a Halloween costume party. It's true, conspiracy theorists, quacks peddling fake medicine, and the deniers of evolution, climate change, and vaccine science are bigger threats than ever. With PsyCon 2018, let's show them that they have just met their match. We'll see you in Las Vegas. For more information and to book your tickets, visit csiconference.org. That's psiconference.org.
Monster Talk theme music is by Pete Stealing Monkeys. Thanks again for listening.
Did you know that you can now subscribe to Skeptic Magazine digitally? Just grab our free Skeptic Magazine app, currently compatible with iOS, Android, PC, Mac, Kindle Fire, Kindle Fire HD, and BlackBerry Playbook. Head over to skeptic.com/magazine/app to find out more and download more of your favorite Skeptic content.
London's West End. Here, in the winter of 1888, a series of bizarre and violent murders occurred, which remain unsolved to this very day. Jack the Ripper. Was he a prosperous London surgeon? Perhaps a member of British royalty? Well, our bullshit team has unearthed spectacular new evidence, which suggests that Jack the Ripper was, in fact, the Loch Ness Monster.